But now, you said you were in a radio program in 1929.
Yeah.
And it was my impression that commercial radio didn't really begin until 27 or 28. So you must have really been there at the
birth. We came out here in either 29 or 30, I'm not quite sure. And I had been doing some radio before that. So I think I started in New York in about 29.
Your wife told me, and I don't know whether she was giving any secrets away,
no,
that you were 86 years old, or well, 86 years young.
She's a little old.
I didn't say that. I said 85.
I'm going to start a fight here.
that wouldn't be the first one.
Now, was radio your... The reason I raised the point was, I'm just trying to... Did you start in the theater? Were you on the stage before you went to radio?
He was a Shakespearean actor.
Many years. Yes.
A Shakespearean actor.
And
Be careful, don't tell any of
them. I won't, if you want me to shut it off, I will, or if you are concerned about what you say.
I'd rather you shut it off and ask me questions, and then I will answer. But all right, doesn't make any difference. All right. You've got to realize that I still think
that people think of the radio stars, and I consider you a star. The value.
I can't imagine anyone, young people, interested.
Well, I think you'd be surprised at the number
of people.
I think
I would be.
That's why I offered to take you if you would like to travel to Connecticut on October 1st. There's going to be I offered this last year also.
I know
it was around Connecticut, around October.
And Jay, what's his name over there?
Hickerson.
Hickerson. Invited me to come over. No, I think
he never goes anywhere.
Raymond Edward Johnson was there last year.
Yeah,
you know him?
Right. Oh, yeah.
He never goes anywhere.
How is he? He's very ill.
He looked... For the year before, the word out was that he was very, very ill.
Yeah.
He was in a wheelchair.
Yes.
But he seemed to have stamina, and a good deal of stamina. And at the end of the evening, they were there almost all day. They had a dinner there. And at the end of the evening, he did a reading.
What do they do?
Well, mostly nostalgia. People talk about the old radio programs and quizzes.
What's Lisa Parker going? You're doing that right now.
Well, the use of the going would be to share your husband. What I'm saying is that I'm not a selfish person. I want to share your husband because there's so many people who I think would be so happy to see him.
It only makes you feel older. It makes me, not you.
Makes one
feel older.
Well, you were telling me that you were a Shakespearean actor before you got into radio.
Yes.
Now listen, I want to tell you this.
Now remember,
Parker looked so down on radio that we didn't even own one. He wouldn't have one of those silly boxes in the house. And my mother lived in Chicago, and I went out there, and she had a radio. And I came home and I said, it's great, it's wonderful. No, that's no way for an actor to do. That isn't for an actor. Real actors looked down on it terribly in the beginning.
You don't think it was
until they began making
money. There's no way to blackmail you, you know that.
Yeah. Until they began making money, and then they thought better of it.
What was your first radio show? It wasn't the Snow Village show.
No, Fires of Men in New York. I don't know, in Washington I had done something, but in New York it was a series called Fires of Men. And among other things, I think the first one I ever worked in, the first sketch in that series, was based on Service's poem, The Cremation of Sam McGee.
Dangerous Sam McGee.
Yeah.
That's Alaskan, Canadian or Alaskan?
Alaskan, I think. And that pertained to fire, you see. It was sponsored by some like a furnace company or something like that. Or maybe a coal company, I'm not sure. The furnace, I think. And then the same director, or the same authors who were writing that series wrote Sutherland Sketches, which eventually turned into Soul Village Sketches. And because I worked in the one series, I went into the other series. And we, Arthur Allen and I and several others, did Soul Village or Sutherland Sketches off and on, not always 52 weeks, but off and on, for 19 seasons, I think it was, over 19 years. And at the same time, Arthur and I did a series which is on 5 days a week, and we did two or three broadcasts a day of it, because at that time you had to do a delayed series for the coast and the Middle West.
That was 15, and Snow Village was 16, and then you did two or three others, did about 20 broadcasts a week.
Was it all from the same network, or
network? He lived in New York. I lived out here. In
CBS and NBC and WWE. We were sponsored on this early series, The Savage Boys, by Swift in Chicago. And then things commenced to go wrong, and they offered us a chance to renew it at a reduced price, and I wouldn't do it, and so it went off the air. Very few people know about the Stebbins Boys, but many people, through the years, the letters that I have had from people talking about the old days, 5 out of 6 would speak of Sutherland or Soul Village Sketches, although I did literally thousands of radio sketches through the many years I was at it. And they speak of Fred Allen.
Are you originally from New England?
Maine.
And, sometimes you think of actors on TV or in the films being typecast, the typical villain or the pretty boy. Did they, it seemed almost that you played the role of the country.
Yeah, that I came.
Right. Was that constant, or did you ever break that typecast? I thought I heard your voice, again, remember, I was wrong on the firefighters, but I also thought I heard your voice on a mystery series. I can't remember whether it was either The Thin Man or Mr. and Mrs. North.
I was on The Thin Man.
That was it.
A number of times, not regularly, but, off and on. Incidentally, the man who produces the mystery theater,
Hyman Brown,
also did The Thin Man. I mean, produce it. And I was on it, off and on. Claudia Morgan was the girl, and I can't remember who played. They had two different ones, played the man, I think, but I can't remember his name now. I worked with
somebody. Well, Parker did Broadway shows and even wrote several. He had several plays produced on Broadway.
I also thought I saw you in a movie a couple of years ago, a Doris Day movie. Were you in a Doris Day movie?
Yeah, It Happened to Jane.
Yes. I remember I was in Washington at the time. I was a radio buff at that point.
Yeah.
And I heard the voice, and so we were in a motel room.
But the Russians are coming are the ones that people remember now, because that's so recent. The Russians are coming.
Did you see that?
Yes.
I was in that. Briefly.
Now, see that? I don't remember seeing you in that, but I do remember.
I was an old man with a hearing aid whose daughter is pinned up on the wall by the Russians, hung up on the wall by the Russians. Well, it's very brief. Very brief.
But very funny. And then, another one that is fairly recent is the one that Pam's children looked at the other night.
Angel
in My Pocket. and so he's in my pocket. That's really quite funny.
That was with Andy Griffith.
Well, that's only how many years ago?
Well, six, I guess, maybe.
Yeah.
I didn't. You travel out west to do that, to California?
Oh, yeah. I've been out there many times. No, not many times. I made about 12 movies, I think. I'm trying to think.
One Hitchcock.
Yeah, I was with Alfred Hitchcock.
I can't remember which one it was.
Do they
were trouble with Harry?
Oh, yeah.
When you do a film, do you think that they're choosing you, again, I don't want to mean to say anything that's going to be offensive, but are they choosing you for your voice, or are they choosing you for the character that you...
I would think for the character. I would think so. You know, years ago, I was with the Kate Smith for a long time.
Wrote it.
I wrote some of the material. And there used to be people out in the alley at the stage door as the, principally to see Kate Smith, of course, but and as I came out, I heard some girl or woman say, he always plays the farmers. That's pretty much what I mean. Oh, you asked about before radio. I was with Walter Houston on Broadway, the first time Walter ever played on Broadway. He had been in vaudeville at the Palace, but he had never done a legitimate play before. I knew him very well. And, you know, he's John Houston's father.
I remember Walter Houston in Rain. Wasn't he in the film Rain?
In the film, yes.
And he does that famous September song.
That's right. Yeah, Father Knickerbocker
Holiday. Right.
Yeah.
This was before those.
Yeah, well, this was before those.
Zona Gale.
He was in Dodsworth.
Oh, he was great. I thought he was great in Dodsworth. He was a very clever man.
And a nice man, too.
Yes, very nice man. I think John may be a little eccentric, but so many of them are. His son, I mean, John.
Well, I won't comment. I'm not a critic, but
well, I'm not.
I think he kind of puts it on.
I think
that's what Parker
more than
means.
More than what he really.
I think
but Walter,
maybe.
Yeah. Walter, but Walter wasn't
serious.
Like that. He was
Walter
right down to earth.
Walter was very nice. Well, ask me something.
I just don't want to interrupt. I'd rather hear you speak than me.
Well, I have nothing.
How did you get started? I guess this is a question most people would ask. How did you get started with Allen's Alley and Frodo?
Oh, yes. Well, I worked on some special hour program. I don't know. It was a mantra. And Fred was the MC, sort of, I think, you know. And I think that was the first time I ever met him. And from that, he had me on his program. But Alan's Alley was on the air before I ever joined. I was with him 3.5 seasons, a half season of television, which Fred was never happy in. We did, and so it wasn't a good program, but I think he liked the last one that we ever did on the air in television. And I think he was happy in that, but previously he liked radio, I know, and he liked vaudeville. He had been in vaudeville for years, and but he never was happy in television. And so it didn't last.
Well, he wasn't successful. You're never happy if you aren't successful.
Well,
just talking to my wife this morning about Fred Allen and Jack Benny as two contemporaries.
Yeah.
And, you know, their famous feuds with one another. But Jack Benny seemed to just meld right into TV.
Yes, he did.
Fred Allen, for some reason, I remember his last few years on the radio, he was always critical of TV on the radio.
I know.
He was critical of the quiz programs, particularly. He had he had one policy or one announcement where he got on the air and said, that if you're listening to my program and they call you for one of the quiz programs and you miss a prize because they call me, our insurance policy will pay you.
That's true. He did. He carried it.
They say that his wife, Portland Hoppe, or I don't know what her name is, but it was Portland Hoppe on stage, or I guess, that she has been very, very unhappy or bitter about radio or about the collectors of the tapes, for example. I know Jack Benny, when he was alive, there were a lot of people out in California who wrote to me and said that he was always active, always successful, but as successful as he was, he would let people like myself, strangers, just come into his house, go down to his basement, and tape, make copies of his programs, because he wanted to share them with people. Mm-hmm. And Portland Hoppe, the widow of Fred Allen, has just the opposite point of view.
Fred was very generous to Parker. He just gave him everything because everybody wanted to use that name, and he kept asking Fred if it was okay, and finally he said, wrote him a letter and said, it's yours, you, nobody else can do it.
Portland married a man named Joe Rhines, and they live in California, most of the time. And I knew Joe Rhines very briefly because he was an orchestra conductor on some program I worked on. But he eventually married Portland, and we generally have a Christmas card from them in California. But I have heard that. I think maybe that the husband is very careful about things now rather than Portland would be. But I don't know about that. But Fred was very generous with everybody. Incidentally, only a couple of weeks ago, one of the people who used to be on the alley, Allen's Alley, before I was, died.
Alan Reed?
Yes,
Full Stamp Openshaw.
That's right. That was before I... No, he was on, I think, one or two programs that I worked on with Fred, but he had left as a city character before, the year before.
His name was Bergman, was it?
Yeah, Teddy Bergman was his real name. Alan Reed was his stage name. And he did very well out in California. He did that Flintstones, I think.
Fred Flintstone, the voice.
Yeah, and I saw him once when I was out there, and he got to be very heavy. He was inclined to be heavy. I read his obituary only. But Minerva Pius, Mrs. Nussbaum, you know, she lives in New York now. I saw her last, I went to Cape Cod for some anniversary thing, and Minnie was there, and Pete Donald did Ajax Cassidy, the Irishman, and Senator Claghorn was Kenny Delmar, and he was also in Cape Cod.
They all went up and did a show up there.
That's the last time I saw it. But.
And who was it that did Fred Allen?
On the air, you mean?
No, up there. Cape Cod.
Well, I don't know his name. I never seen him before.
Was he anything like Fred?
Yes, he was very good.
And did he do Jack Benny too that night?
Yeah. But I don't think it was Jack Benny was an artist boy. He could pull over material. He had good material, but he knew how to handle it. He was one of the greatest.
You talk about material, and I'm wondering, you said you did some writing for Kate Smith.
Yeah.
In terms of the success of a radio program, what weight would you place on the comedy writers or the material in terms of that versus the delivery? Or
about 75%, I think so. That's why, well, it used to be, I don't know that it is now, but some of the people who would write, of course I know about rural things more than I did about city thing. And some of these authors who would write are all things. I was thinking the other day, I worked in, this is not radio or television, this is theater. I worked in Carousel in New York. Do you ever see Carousel?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I did the Star Tender, the old man up on the ladder. And, you know, Carousel was adapted from the Hungarian.
Molnár.
Molnár. And was converted to New England. But I could have written with no ego. I could have written better dialogue. Not the music and the songs, naturally, the lyrics, but the dialogue I thought was could have been improved a great deal. They were satisfied with it. I mean, the public was. It's a great show. I think Carousel is a great musical.
What if the public really paid much attention to the lyric, to the dialogue, or if they were just enthralled by the music?
And that was great, I thought. I saw the original William, and when Eva Le Gallien did it, was it? But I think they could have used better dialogue. But that's neither here nor there. They did all right with it.
But tell him about working with Eva.
Well, Joan, Cecil Holm. How is this running out?
If it is, we'll turn it over. No, we still have a little...
Now what would you like to drink? Would you like iced tea, iced coffee, hot tea,
Are you going to drink something?
Root beer.
Are you going to drink something?
Well, I'll see what you choose first.
Anything that you drink, I'll join you.
Anything Mr. Fenway drinks. He always has orange juice.
Wait until this runs out. Okay. Then he won't have to use up the tape with dialogue between us.
That's all right.
But that's interesting about Eva. I mean, Parker liked her so much.
Oh. Well,
he likes everybody that he works with. He never has any trouble. And naturally, they like him because he
maybe
never...
Maybe not. John Cecil Holm, H-O-L-M, wrote in collaboration, I guess, with George Abbott, Three Men on a Horse, you know, the old comedy?
Yes.
And others. And there was a book called The Southwest Corner, lady in, Vermont or New Hampshire, I don't know which one. And John Cecil Holm dramatized it. And we did it at Saratoga in the summer theater. And then we did it in Philadelphia and in New York with Eva Le Gallien. And she was very nice to work with. That's the first time I ever met her, knew her. She was very nice to work with. She's been appraised wonderfully in that royal family, you know. They revived that with Eva, the old actress. Is it running out?
it'll run another minute or two, I'm sure, and then we'll flip it over. I could listen to you for as long as you're patient enough to speak.
I've been looking for you all my life.
Well, have you ever considered writing an autobiography?
No, nobody would. Sometimes somebody has said that, and I said nobody would read it, but the grandchildren, and I doubted it.
They were always at him to even talk. He won't talk like this for any of us, you know. We're supposed to know it all.
Yeah.
But you know, you forget after so many years. You really and truly forget it all. And both, we have twins. We have twin girls. And they are always, whenever they come. Now next week, Jane will come down from Connecticut for a week. And she's always at him to let her take notes or do something with her. He just brushes her aside and says, why don't you go out to a movie or why don't you go out to lunch?
to your own daughter, huh? Uh-huh. That's cool.
Yeah. Oh.
I would think that that there would be interest in your...
No, I you know.
Because you've known so many famous people.
You have to have a little bit of egotism to write a book about yourself. And Parker, although he has a very good opinion of his ability, he knows just what it is, but he doesn't have that kind of egotism.
No, but he can. There are probably a lot of stories that he could tell about people like Mrs. McGowan, Miss McGowan.
Well, that's true, if he ever sat down to do it. But he'd rather fool around writing a play. He'd much rather write a play than write about himself.
Have you written?
Yes, I wrote one, which I sold to George Cohan. You know George Cohan?
George M. Cohan. Seven Keys to Baldface.
Yeah. And he had the right to, he started it, or he played the leading character, and he had the right, I gave him the proviso, to change it any way he wanted to suit himself, because nobody else would ever want to buy it, and he did, in Boston, and in New Haven, and in New York, but it was a flop. But the other one, in New York, was a mystery play I wrote called Cuckoos on the Hearth. And that ran, I think, 129 performances.
What year was that? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's in the 40s. In the 40s. And then it was published by Dramatist Play Service. And it has been done, well, I can't say every state, but it's been done all over this country, and in South America, and in Hawaii, and in Japan.
Where did Leo see it when he was in the service?
Japan.
It seems so ridiculous.
They wrote that in the 40s, and they're still putting it on, still doing it.
Very, very seldom now, because it stated it was about the war. Well, I mean, that entered into it. The man was an inventor, and he invented something used in the war. So it's passé now, but it was done in Pixel once. The high school did.
We didn't go to see it.
No, I went to a rehearsal. They, well, you know, they were nice kids.
But I'll tell you what it did do, among other things. Well, it kept us in salt, I would say. Not much more for 50 years, but it made Percy Kilbride.
Parker
wouldn't play the part himself, and it made Percy Kilbride.
I wrote the part for myself, but I was tied up with radio in the evenings, you know, regularly, under contract, and Percy did the part, and he got notices that long in the papers. And I took him to Hollywood, and he did about 8 of those non-Par Kettle. And then he retired, and I went out to do the final one. It was the final. The audiences naturally were looking. Percy was a small man, big nose, and he was funny, but he was...
But well, not legitimate at all.
He was... And... so I never did another one, and I was glad. I never saw it. I never wanted to see it. I knew it wasn't good, but I got paid for it.
Marjorie Main was still in it.
Yeah, but we had known Marjorie. That's that squeaking metal thing over there. We had known, Catherine had known Marjorie up in Fargo, North Dakota, in stock company, before I ever saw Catherine or Marjorie. And then Marjorie was out here at our house, and eventually I worked with her in the Montreux Kettle, that one. So I knew her very well. She died not long ago and lived in...
Parker was saying last night, if they ever did the life of Bella Abzug, Marjorie, if she was alive, would be a natural for it.
Yes, she very much the same.
Well, yeah, she looked very much like...
Yeah.
Well, of course, she'd be very old now because she's as old as I am.
Kind of raucous in the in appearance, not necessarily personally, but the appearance was, I think, one of the raucous...
I think Bella's going to get it, don't you?
I don't want to show my male chauvinism, but I'd almost like to see anybody but Bella.
I like Koch.
Koch, Edward Koch, or Mario Cuomo, almost anybody. I wouldn't vote for Beam, but I don't think...
I don't think he has a chance now since his report.
I'm kind of sorry for the little guy, though.
Well, he had his year in the sun, or 4 years in the sun.
Well, we're getting away from show business, or maybe not.
Maybe it's more interesting.
No, I can talk about that anytime. Were you on the stage also?
Very short time. I mean, there's only room for one, unless you're a Lon Fontaine. There's only room for one.
Yeah, there was the great team of all time.
I couldn't run
Lon
home.
He's very ill.
And take care of twins.
He died. He died.
Must have been this last week then.
Well, about 10 days.
Within the past week or so, I remember hearing about him being very, very ill.
Oh, he was. I saw him when he was a juvenile man, thin, young, in Boston before he ever... He used to work at a surf company in Boston at Kessel Square. And he said in an interview that he worked for $10 a week, I think, or 15 or something. That was before equity in any scale.
You worked for almost that little.
Yeah, that's right.
Speaking of equity and scale and that sort of thing, I thought I heard you say that you found after a while that radio paid better than Shakespeare, or better than the theater.
He gave up Shakespeare because he had a family to send to college. And
it was steady, and the theater might last 2 weeks or... In fact, I did a play in New York called Live Life Again. And an author, a dramatist, who had written a good deal and was a very capable man, named Don Totoro, T-O-T-H-E-R-O-H, had taken the Hamlet story and put it in the Middle West, and with the same kind of characters under different names actually, and modernized it. And the man who played the older man, the father of the Hamlet.
Hamlet's father was a ghost. Must be Hamlet's uncle.
Yeah, Hamlet's uncle. Yeah. Anyway, the juvenile who played Hamlet was very. His agent was very harsh about getting him the star dressing room. I think it was in the Belasco Theater. And finally they arranged that. And the play opened one night and closed the next. After all the trouble about the star dressing
room. But many of the interviews that I've heard from some of the people who were in early radio claim that the only way to make money in radio was to play many different roles. They'd get something like $15 or $20 for each performance. And sometimes they'd be on and off.
I'll tell you a story, and this is true. I was very resentful when Parker was young and handsome and had this beautiful speaking voice.
Now he's old and handsome.
That he was playing, and he's always played that same character, always.
Well,
so I said, I happened to go to the Peekskill post office, and some mail clerk hollered something at me about one of his characters, and I resented it. So I said to Parker, it's about time you stop playing that character. You can play anything. You can play Hamlet. You can play anything. So he said, you go down to the advertising agency and tell them what you think about. And he never in his life had let me interfere in any shape, but I knew this girl very well. So I went down and poured out my soul to her. And when I got all through, she said, when all those pretty boys are in the actor's home, Parker be working.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just what happened.
Well, I don't want to compare you to someone like Boris Karloff, but I heard, again on tape, an interview that was done by a British radio fellow of Boris Karloff just a year or two before he passed away. And one of the questions that was asked of Boris Karloff was, did you ever resent being cast in the monster roles? And Karloff's response was, no, because prior to that I was a character actor, but I never really made any good, and it was the monster roles that kept me and
that's
my family going
that's
for all of our lives. So
if you're in it to make money, or if you are in it for fame and want to go hungry, all right, but I mean, if you want to make money at it.
He was a very nice man. I worked with him once, I think, on radio interview maybe or something. I don't know, but he was a very nice man.
But you see, there are people who not only collect the radio programs, but there are also quite a few interviews
with the
stars that are available, and these are fascinating.
Yeah.
Has a fellow named Richard Lamparsky ever tried to get in touch with you?
No.
He's,
I never remember the name.
He has written three or four books called Whatever Became Of.
Oh, I have one of his books.
And invariably he will go around and interview people who have been very famous and who dropped out of the public life to find out, you know, what are they doing. Some of them are still in the field, some of them are in other businesses.
Some of them are in the actor's home.
Yes.
I'll tell you something. When I was young, there was an actor around New England named Alexis Luce, L-U-C-E, Lexi Luce, they call it. Very good, leading man, you know, in stock companies and so forth. And as I told you, we did this series, The Savage Boys, not for very long, but we did it two or three times a day, night. And years afterwards, when it had been abandoned by the advertising agencies, I got a letter from a man in Bangor, Maine, or somewhere in Maine, and asking about the rights, you know, who owned the rights to the series, The Savage Boys. He said he was interested in getting a friend to use it on a Maine radio station. This was before television. Lexi Luce, he said he now drove the rural delivery, main rural delivery mail route somewhere in Maine. He was looking for something to do on radio. I don't know how it ever turned out. I just turned it over to the author of it. And by the way, I told you, the author of the historical sketches on Circling Land sketches series lived,
Henry Carlton.
Yeah, what's his street?
I don't know, but Carlton.
Well, right.
Harmon. Yeah.
Well, better write that one down. He's still there?
No, he died.
I told you, there's nobody still alive except this one girl in Greece. Ruthie Russell is one girl that Parker took out of high school and put her in his company in Washington, D.C., and somebody sent me the thing out of the Post, and they said to her, it was a big interview with her, and they asked her how she ever got into radio, and she said, Parker Bentley helped me get into radio. She's actually the only one still alive, isn't she, Parker? Director, authors?
No, I think so, yeah.
Assistant directors?
and the director, the original, he died. Jerry Staub.
Jerry Staub. He lived in Harmon.
He lived in, well, that's Corcoran, isn't it?
No, that's Harmon.
His wife, his widow, still lives over here, or did a show.
You see, when people came out from New York, Harmon was absolutely the limit. You couldn't commute any farther than that. And besides, you got wonderful service. You know, they change the engines there and you got terrific service. And when we were looking for a house, I looked in Pleasantville and all around and purchased it. This is the limit. I mean, the thought of riding on a train that long when you just come out of New York or something, you know. And that's why they all came out here.
How long have you lived in this house? This is beautiful.
About 49 years.
Doesn't look that, the house doesn't look that old. It's just...
Well, it was pretty much...
I said to a friend of ours who lives down the road here, I said, I don't know how we fell into this gold mine. Well, Parker almost hit the ceiling. But, I mean, we bought it for peanuts, and, well, a house just up beyond us had just been sold for over, they asked $275,000, they didn't quite get it.
You have a lot of land here, a tremendous amount of
about
land.
About 9 acres. It goes way down.
You don't do all this yourself, do you, all this gardening?
It goes down
such
here.
As it is.
To a brook.
Catanism.
Beautiful.
But of course Parker won't even have it appraised. He doesn't care what it's worth as long as we keep warm and eat here.
I see the bread company has got somebody else now trying to imitate your voice.
Deckridge. Yeah. Oh, well.
I was okay, a, now I'm going to get up. What's it going to be? Onward Christian Soul.
Root beer is fine. Are
you mean that?
That's
would you rather have iced tea, iced coffee, hot tea,
no,
hot
my
coffee?
My wife is trying to get me to lose weight. So.
Oh, well, then I guess maybe root beer is the thing, isn't it?
Anything without calories, if you've got...
Well, how about pink lemonade, then? That's even less.
Okay.
What would you rather have?
If you'll join me, I'll have some pink lemonade. Okay, if you've got it ready.
No, but it takes about 2 minutes.
turn it off now, why don't you? I'll get a resume later. No?
You might say there might be a gem there that I would miss, and
well,
I don't want to miss any gems.
I
can always edit this.
Well, I hope you do. I hope you do. Yeah, I was with them a long, long time, 20-something years. And I used to go all over the country to their sales meetings and do a little stuff in gossip bubble. But I haven't been with them for about 3 years. I tell you, Campbell Soup owns Pepperidge Farm. It's a different setup now. In the old, you probably know the story. Mr. and Mrs. Rudkin lived in Norwalk, or near Norwalk, and he was a Wall Street man, and she was, well, a housewife, a mother, and she had 3 boys, and the story that I have always heard was that one of the boys was ill, and for some reason she commenced baking homemade bread, and things weren't any too good for Mr. Rudkin at that time, and he used to take some into town, either to give or... Anyway, I think I'm right about that. I know that she put it in the local stores, and that led to it enlarging. So when I first was with him, Mr. Rudkin was alive, and Mrs. Rudkin, and 2 boys. One lives in Paris, but at the time he did anyway. The other 2 boys were with the firm, so I knew the whole family very well. And then I was in Chicago. We were there with for a sales meeting, and the word came that Mr. Rudkin had died, and one of the sons was with us, and he came back with us, and it wasn't too long after before Mrs. Rudkin died. But meanwhile, she had sold the business, or she retained some, you know, but to Campbell Soup. And Campbell Soup is a very thrifty organization. And I never had many dealings with them, but they're all right. But anyway, we came to the parting of the ways. But I didn't mind. I enjoyed going around to the sales meetings because they were nice people. And money was no object. I'm talking about the time the Rudkin family had. They would give these huge dinners and cocktail parties for the local brokers, the food brokers, the bread dealers. But that was long enough. I was with them a long time.
Have you, what was the last work that you've done in terms of the profession? Have you been pretty well retired for the last couple of years?
Yeah, I haven't done anything lately.
Would you take something on if you had the opportunity?
I doubt it. I don't know. But they wouldn't send away for me now. God, being as old as
the reason I ask, I assume that you have an agent.
No, not anymore. No. I did on the coast. I had two, and one moved to retirement, and the other one handled I was out there. Do you know when you hear him or see him, Andy Griffith?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Very, very nice person. Very nice.
He's on the Ritz crackers now.
Yes. You know, he should be a very wealthy man, because all those old television programs that he did, and Don Knotts, you know Don Knotts?
Yes.
I made a picture with Don Knotts out there. And when I saw Don Knotts, it wasn't such a bad picture, but it wasn't terribly good. And I don't know who devised the name, but the name of Don Knotts played a character named Fig, F-I-G-G. I can't remember his first name. Anyway, Fig. And the name of the picture, of all things, was How to Frame a Fig. Now, I could have thought of, anybody could have thought of it, but anyway, it was quite funny in spots. And Don told me, I had seen him for many years, and when I first met him out there, he said, you know, when I saw you last, or you saw me last, it was at WOR, and I was one of the children, or one of the boys, adolescent boy, in Bobby Benson. That used to be a radio.
Don Knotts was in Bobby Benson?
I think that was the one. He's one of the.
I remember Bobby Benson.
Yeah, I think he was one of the younger characters.
You don't smoke. That's a good boy.
Well, I've got enough vices. So
you do.
I'll stay away from.
You do smoke.
No, I don't.
Well, that won't put much fat onto you.
I'll tell my wife. Thank you so much.
You should have brought her along.
Oh dear.
Well, you know who wanted to come along? I have a 9-year-old boy, and yeah. I didn't take him with me to the convention last year.
No.
And why'd you bring him along?
When I came home,
I have a 9-year-old boy right next door that would love to play.
When I came home, I told him that the actor that played, I don't know whether he played the Green Hornet or announced the Green Hornet, but he was at the convention last year. And I mentioned this to my son, and he got very excited. I should have taken him. Who wants me to take him this year? When I told my wife yesterday that I was coming here to see you, his first question was, is he a famous man? I said, yes, he is. He's a very famous. Not everybody knows him, but he's a famous. I told my mother. I spoke to my mother last night, and I said I was going to be visiting Parker Fenley today. She said, well, I was coming to see her. She lives in the Bronx.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm busy. I'm going to be visiting Parker Fenley. She said,
yeah.
I remember Parker Fenley. He was on many radio programs.
Yeah.
So my son wanted to come to get your autograph, you see.
Well, why didn't you bring him along?
Because I think he would drive us all crazy.
No,
he
wouldn't.
Well, I'll tell you, the girl who has these tapes, who lives right next door, is the one with the 9-year-old son. Now, Parker, will you explain, what is your first
Dave,
name?
Dave.
David. I like that. I have a grandson. It's my favorite name, David. And his mother said she had four sons, and she waited till the last one to call him David, and she said, that's my favorite name. And I said, well, why'd you wait till the fourth? You might not have had the fourth one. I can't be mystering people. I'm too old, and you're too young. How does Nancy have those tapes? Who was it? Who gave you? Was it the man up at Cape Cod?
Yeah, a man I met in Cape Cod.
That he didn't know?
Not before, no. And he sent me some tapes. He was a collector like you.
Mm-hmm.
And
you probably know him.
I didn't have a player. And we took it up to the neighbors to...
Right next door.
...play of the Sicily, of the Snow Village.
Snow Village.
Yes, yes.
Well, I may... did he give you many? Did he give you one or two or something?
I never heard of them.
I think there are four of them.
Mm-hmm. It's possible Jane, that I may have them.
Jane, our daughter, lives in Connecticut. And Parker went up and listened to a couple, and he said, I thought the Rosses were getting bored with that, so I called them all. And they've kept the rest. It must be a year ago, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, they only kept them because I...
Because we never asked them.
I didn't take them back, but...
Well, we always intended to go up and listen to them, and we never got around to it. Just too far next door.
One of them. I do remember. I heard...
Help yourself.
Do you drive? Do either one of you drive?
Do I drive?
Drive.
Parker drives.
I was going to say, are you far from Route 202 here? Or from Route 6?
I lost my license.
I think the phone is ringing.
After 60 years, because of my eyes.
I would be delighted to have you as guest at our house for dinner if you'd like to come
nice
out.
Of you.
Really consider it, I consider it an honor.
Thank
and
you.
I would be happy to play any of the tapes that you might be on.
I know.
Well, I won't be bored. I assure you that.
I was. I heard them for the first time in many years. Of course, one was about Hiram Neville and the boy going fishing.
Yes.
You have that?
That's the one where he plays hooky from school.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
I thought that was the one you meant when you said.
Right.
That. Yeah. And the other one, I can't remember.
I think it's one where they have to pay for a window in the church.
Oh,
and one of them is too cheap. One of them is supposed to be a skinflint. I'm not sure which one. You're the skinflint.
Yeah. Did we talk? When I talk, can you? I think you better turn your, because I'm going to say some things. I don't. Can you turn it off and start again?
If you'd like me to.
Yeah. The phone rang and I went to the phone and he said, this is Hans von Wright. I've listened to you for many years and I just come back from Europe, staying overnight in New York. And I said that when I was in New York again, I'd call you up and tell you. And he did. Wasn't that, you know, I never saw him in my life. He never saw me. But I mean, he's a pretty eminent actor. To take the trouble to call up somebody he'd never known or seen, I thought it was very nice of him. And I never have. I didn't see him when he was in New York, but he wasn't there. Right?
I wanted Parker to go and see the show or to send him a telegram or something, but...
It didn't last long.
I don't think it lasted
he said
a week.
If it lasted, it'd be all right to send the telegram, but if it...
I think recently I read that Molly Pecan moved to Croton. She's living
there. Really?
Living there with a sister, and she was in our newspaper. I don't forget the same newspaper that we did. There was a festival about 2 weeks ago, and they had a feature story about her.
Oh.
They say she's 80 years old.
She's very clever woman.
Oh yeah, she's very clever.
Yeah.
Very good.
Do you know her? Or?
No, but I've watched her in interviews and read about her.
Well, long before you came out here, Jackie Gleason had a house just over the mountain there. A great, big, spectacular place. Columbia bought it from him to...
CBS.
He seems to be pretty well settled in Florida now.
Well, he's trying to make... Doesn't have to. He doesn't want to. He's making a comeback. He's going to do something.
And didn't he call his company Peekskill?
I think.
Yes, he did. I know
producing,
he did.
He called it Peekskill Producing Company or something like that.
And he married a girl from Peekskill. You know, one of them along the line.
He just recently married his secretary, I think. But there was a feature story about him in one of the papers showing that he had a facelift. He was losing weight, and also his eyes, I guess, were kind of baggy.
That's right.
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Well, this is Jackie Gleason.
Just lose the weight. Never mind it. I think that's ridiculous.
I tell you, he was remarkable in when he had that series. I worked with him twice maybe or once. And he had the most amazing memory. He could run through a thing once or twice.
Right. Parker said he never saw such a memory in his life.
Ralph Bellamy, he had that same kind of camera memory. He could, it was amazing.
I would think that going from radio to anything else, where in radio you can read your script,
That's why it would be such a
pain in the neck to have to start remembering it.
I know, that's true.
They could run from one studio to the other and read it.
That's true. I'll tell you, who used to live over on Mount Airy, you know where Mount Airy
is? Yes.
Everett Sloan. Now he must be in some of the tapes you have because he worked in so many. And especially he worked for Hyman Brown.
Didn't he die recently, Everett Sloan?
He killed himself.
I didn't know that, but I thought he had died. Yeah. He was, I think he was with Orson Welles in Mercury Theater.
I guess he was. He was a very fine actor and a terribly
nervous,
tense actor.
There's some of the people in Croton tell me that Howard De Silva lives in this area. I don't know exactly where, but somewhere in this area.
I don't know him, but I know who he is.
You probably wanted a glass of beer, didn't you?
No, I didn't even want that.
Aaron Copeland lives somewhere.
You know, Mount Airy, many, many years ago, well, when we first came out here, it was a real, real artist colony. I mean, of all kinds. Dancers, singers, and real, you know, artists that do this.
People tell me in Croton that there were a lot of communists who lived up in that area also.
I wasn't going to add that, but that was true. Well, and that was true.
You know, Faye Bainter owned land up on Mount Airy. You remember Faye Bainter?
Yes.
And this is before your time, but Lenore Orrick owned a big house right in Croton. I can't remember.
She was a Belasco star. There were an awful lot of theatrical people out here then. Because, as I say, they thought they were really getting as far out of New York as they could reasonably live, you know.
Well, it is. It's a good hour by train.
Yeah. 45 minutes. About 40, wasn't it, at the best?
49 on the express.
But when Parker was working so much, he kept a room in a hotel in New York and just came out weekends. And, well, he couldn't. I mean, the last broadcast for the Coast was
1 o'clock.
Yes, so how could you get a train? He once had a little trouble with the income tax people because they said, who on earth would be listening to radio at 1 o'clock in the morning?
Well, I can recall as a kid, turning on the radio in the daytime and listening to a soap opera in the daytime.
Yeah.
And then later at night, you know, sometimes when you drive at night, you'll get stations from Chicago up in the Midwest.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand why I would be able to hear the same. I'm not a radio fan, no.
Well, what is she, television then?
Well, she's a musician. She teaches the piano and quite a bit. But, she's not really a. She watched television, but not about it really. My children are TV addicts.
I'm sure. Two children.
Two children, a little girl and a little boy.
That's nice, one of each.
That's when you stop. When you've had one of each, you know there's nothing else to, nothing in between, so you don't go any further.
That's right. Well, nowadays I don't even know how you can educate two. Well, if they're smart enough, of course they'll win it.
Well, we hope so. They're really young right now.
It still costs quite a lot, doesn't it?
She's 11. No, she's 12, I think, and she can't wait till she's a teenager. Next year she'll be a teenager.
Yeah.
He's 9.
Well, I hope she doesn't go and sit in 5 cars. That's why I'm always afraid of these girls sitting there. The hairdresser that I go to, and it is over in that shopping area there, he has a girl, and I said, after all this hoop-de-doo first, I said, I hope your daughter doesn't think she's old enough to be out in a parked car. He said, she thinks she is, but she doesn't, isn't allowed to do it. And I said, I hope not, because somebody else is going to get this idea right away.
Well, there was someone, I got direction from someone in a parked car out here a little while ago, so that they serve some useful purpose. You said you did Snow Village for 19 seasons.
Off and on, yes.
Off and on.
Yeah.
And Fred Allen for I don't know how many seasons.
3.5.
What would...
3 radio and a half a season of television.
What would you say, although those 3 years, I think probably for people who remember radio, I would guess those 3 years have left a greater impression than almost anything else that you've done. Do you find that true? Of people who remember you, that's the main...
They've all died off. The older, the ones who used to listen.
There are only a few
to the original broadcast are dropping off like flies.
What programs other than Fred Allen and Snow Village were you on any steady basis?
Well, Julius Anderson and Frank Cromedy used to go to Boston. After he did his Snow Village, he would get on an all-night train to go to Boston and broadcast up there with Blackstone Cigar.
Well, one I was on, I can't remember so many. One I was on a lot was Grand Central Station. And
that was daytime, wasn't it?
Saturday afternoon, I think.
Saturday afternoon.
Oh, you remember!
Yes.
And there was one I did for Kroger Grocery Company in the Middle West. It was called Mary Foster, the editor's daughter.
How many years, Parker?
I have several of those.
13 years, I think.
I'm not sure. 13 years. We used to kid about it because Parker has a cousin who you passed by her house on Hunterbrook Road, Mary Rochford, but she was Mary Foster. We used to always kid about this. Mary Foster, the editor, laugh uproariously.
Did she play the part?
No. She's not an actor. So, now that was the character's name. Mm-hmm. So I was out in Chicago. My mother lived at the Edgewater Beach in Chicago. And I turned on the radio. And I hear Parker. And I said, what on earth is that? I've never heard that program. Why, that's Mary Foster, the editor's daughter.
It wasn't heard in New York. It was heard
Kroger's
in
Bread.
I've got
Midwest.
Two of those programs.
Well,
if you haven't heard that for a while, I'd be... when I... Sent you into stopping by the house. I want to play that one for you.
For a brief time, it was on WOR here, but that was long after.
13 years he did it, and I had never heard it till I went to Chicago. Well, I wasn't sitting around wishing I could hear it or anything.
I'll tell you what number of months ago, our dog was stolen, and they used to take paid ads on the local radio station in Pixie, and I called up to find out if I could put an ad on, and they had discontinued it, sort of. Anyway, he didn't seem much interested, but he said, maybe this is a news story, and he put it on the news. Just because he heard my name. And from that, a man who has a program on...
Nice guy, isn't he?
Yes, WLNA in Pixel called me up and asked if I would be interviewed. And I wasn't very anxious to, but I came in, he sounded...
We found our dog, so we had to...
Yeah. And so I told him the story, and I told it to you. There used to be a woman member of a garden club that Catherine belonged to, and the woman was very deaf and probably never heard or listened to the radio, maybe never wanted to, but she wanted to be polite. When she saw Catherine occasionally, and she would say, I always forget, is your husband Lum or Abner?
Oh, Parker, tell him the story about when you were making personal appearances and you were walking along with Arthur up in Albany.
Well, I don't think...
It's quite a long story. Well, it was like that.
Well, did you ever hear the program Sunday Night at Seth Parker's? Philip Sword.
I think I have one program in that series. Wasn't it religious?
Sunday evening, yeah.
Yes, I have one excerpt, one program. Were you on that one?
No. I guess I won't tell that yet. I don't think I should. It's about a man who's dead. I don't want to talk about it.
Well, don't speak ill of the, we're not supposed to do that.
Some
people who have who've talked about Philip H. Lord have not spoken too kindly of him.
I can understand that.
Mr. Gangbusters.
That's right, he's a very successful, great businessman.
Didn't he also do David Harding, Counter-Spy?
I think so. I'm not sure, but he did...
Were you on Counter-Spy at all?
I don't think I ever...
There's another... You know, again, there must be people out there trying to imitate your voice.
Well, I tell you, there used to be an actor here at the restaurant.
The restaurant, yes. He was the only one when Parker couldn't do a show, a radio show. He would always recommend... He was a young boy, wasn't he, Parker? Fairly young guy.
Quite young.
And another one who does the best imitation of Parker, only that he wouldn't do it, is you know, the boy with Jack Benny.
Dennis Day.
He is
absolutely marvelous.
I couldn't tell if it wasn't myself.
He's absolutely the best. Yeah. There's nobody like him.
He looks, you know, I've seen pictures of him recently.
Well, he does a commercial.
As old as he is, he looks very young.
Oh, he's so old. He was quite young when he went with Jack Benny, wasn't he?
Well, he's, he has 100 children or something.
More or less.
His real name is McNulty, I think. And he had a great many
children. But it was a wonderful tie-up, because he would come on the Jack Benny program, following the Fred Allen program, and do Parker, this imitation, and it was absolutely marvelous.
One program followed the other, you know, Jax followed the other.
None of us could tell the difference. Yeah, he's the only person that doesn't make one little slip. Any of these people who do these imitations, there's always just something they do.
I remember on the Benny program, Jack comes into the room and sees Dennis in my character reading a book, and Jack says to him, what book are you reading? Whatever his name was.
Titus Moody.
I don't know if they use the name, but you know, just, and Dennis said, it's an awful sad book. And Jack says, what is the name of it? He said, Forever Amber. Jack said, that is a sad book. And he said, at my age, she is.
And he was wonderful. Absolutely perfect.
He's a very nice person, too. I heard there's a program on WOR at noon, radio. Jack, what's his name? Critics Circle, Jack O'Brien. And he generally interviews people connected with the theater or television or concert field or something. And he had an agent on yesterday, or a man who handled a great many celebrities, you know. And Jack O'Brien, Jack said, Jack O'Brien, that's his name, isn't it? Asked him, who was the highest priced artist making appearances? And he said, Hope, at least one of the very top, Bob Hope. What do you suppose he does with his money? But you know, I think
he gives it to those golf.
That's right. I said, what do you suppose he does with his money? He was on Fred's program more than once, I think. But I remember one time in particular, and he couldn't be there for the afternoon rehearsal on Sunday because he'd gone up to West Point or somewhere to do a film. He loves to work, evidently.
Yeah.
I don't, can't be the money, he must have so much money.
Well, he must be in his 70s now, Bob Hope.
Yes.
He helps support the government. Let him go on.
Well, I think he loves to.
Well, there are some people, I guess, who if they didn't work, they would, we all know people who retire who suddenly, it's the worst
Parker,
thing I can do.
He would never do anything unless he read the script, and it was something he wanted to do. He's turned down more things than he's done.
But that was not true in the beginning.
He isn't money man. That's why he's living.
You remember Jim Farley. I remember one time in particular, and he couldn't be there for the afternoon rehearsal on Sunday because he'd gone up to West Point or somewhere to do a film. He loves to work, evidently.
Yeah.
I don't, can't get the money, he must have so much money.
Well, he must be in his 70s now, Bob, but...
Yes.
He helps support the government. Let him go on.
Well... I think he loves to.
Well, there are some people, I guess, who if they didn't work, they would, we all know people who retire who suddenly, it's the worst
Parker,
thing I can do.
He would never do anything unless he read the script, and it was something he wanted to do. He's turned down more things than he's done.
But that was not true in the beginning.
He isn't money man. That's why he's living.
You remember Jim Farley, if you're in New York.
Postmaster General.
Yeah. And you know, he was supposed to have one of those camera memories who never forgets a face or a name. And Fred used to have people, guests on the program, not theatrical people necessarily, but he had Jim Farley. And Farley wasn't there for, I think, the Friday rehearsal, but he was there for Sunday morning, afternoon, evening, Sunday morning, and also in the evening, dress rehearsals. And so he sat in a row of chairs, you know, no farther away than that chair from me, and it was in the winter time, and he had seen us get up and do our little stunt. So he could have failed to see and hear us, and it was winter, as I say, and I was walking along the corridor of the RCA building, and they took Jim Farley down in the musician's elevator, so to avoid the autograph people, you know. And he was getting out of the elevator, putting on his overcoat, just as I came up to him in the corridor. And I'd been with him, you know, a good many hours. So I said, good night, Mr. Farley. He said, oh, hello, how are you today? Never had seen me in his life.
He's a politician, though. You remember that?
He only remembered politicians, evidently. You know, people who were... He certainly didn't remember me.
People who could scratch his back.
That's right.
You ought to tell some of the jokes on yourself apropos of that, because Parker can't remember anybody. He was walking through Grand Central one night, rushing for a train, and some guy walked up to him, and he shook hands or put his hand out to shake hands with him and said, You hadn't seen him for a long time. All the guy wanted was a dollar. He had never seen him before.
Well, he misled me because he said, "Hello, partner." And I thought he said, "Parker, you know." And I said, "How have you been, sir?"
Oh, he has a million of them where he hasn't remembered people.
Do any of the radio performers or TV people, I'm sure, their union has been successful in getting them coverage for programs that are done again and again and again, but I wonder if any of the people in the field are getting, what's the phrase I'm looking for, money for programs that have residuals. Is that the part of the radio business, or is that something impossible?
Yeah, it came to being with the AFRA. It was originally the American Federation of Radio Artists, AFRA, and then television came in, and it changed to AFTRA, A-F-T, radio, television radio. And they established rates and rules as the years went on. Back to a certain time, you get residuals, but not before a certain date, you know.
I'm always glad when somebody said, "Oh, I saw one of those old movies." Good. Well, we'll eat this week.
That's what I mean. When I saw that movie in Washington, does that mean that some people were getting money as a result of that?
Which one was it? Oh, the Doris Day.
The Doris Day.
After a certain time, it runs out. You know, you meant about television programs when you spoke of it, didn't you?
Right, because I don't think you could get it for radio. They don't repeat radio programs, so you wouldn't get anything for radio.
No, and the repeats on television, well, you see, I've done so few that have been repeated, I couldn't say. I think, for instance, the Hollywood Squares, for instance. Mm-hmm. You ever see that?
Yes.
Well, all through the summer, there are repeats. Now, I think those people get a certain amount, but I've done so few television programs. I've done pictures that have been repeated on television, and I get back to us. It's descending scale of of residual. At first, you get a certain amount, then through the year, and after time, it runs out.
They say that some of the people who are doing commercials are doing better in commercials than they would if they had their own program.
Yeah. Oh.
Because the commercials are just repeated over and over again in between.
Well,
shows.
You see, now Parker has severed his relationship with Pepperidge, but he still gets the residuals from when they use.
But they very seldom.
His old commercial. Well, the first year, well, he always has a... We can't speak to him during income tax time because he insists upon doing his own. And so I said to him this year, "Oh, but it's wonderful. You don't have to pay anything now. You're not working." And he said, which he shouldn't have done, and he thought better of it afterwards and was sorry he said it, "I made more money this year than I did last because they used his programs so all over the country."
But now they don't. They don't.
Well, these residuals are very nice things.
But you take these, now we look at the news at 6 o'clock, and there's that girl who does the face quencher, lip quencher. In an hour and a half, she's on twice at least, sometimes three times, I think. Now just imagine what she, and many, many others.
But way back, Parker, when you were doing so many, many, many radio programs, there was no such thing as residuals then.
No.
See, that's where the union comes in good.
Yeah.
But they didn't, I don't imagine that too many radio programs were rebroadcast. Well, TV programs will get the summer, during the summer they'll broadcast them again.
Yeah, but there are some stations, as you know, that use old-time radio programs. but there will be no residuals.
Well, don't they have to pay? You can't just put a tape on a radio and broadcast. It's not your property. Don't they have to pay the
that's true.
The original producer or someone's got the copyright
on that? I would think in some cases NBC owns the rights, and in other cases
sponsor in some cases would own the rights.
Right. Standard Oil might own the rights to Shaw Village. I don't know that. I know I don't get anything, naturally.
But when we first started in show business, there was no actor's equity. So you could be stranded out in the middle of no man's land, and if you didn't have a check from home, there you would be. And Parker fought tooth and nail. He wasn't going to be like a ditch digger and a carpenter and join a union, but it's been a wonderful godsend to actors, that union.
Yeah.
He didn't want it. Oh, he fought it. He said no, he wasn't going to join any union. Well, this is an altruistic way of looking at it, but when it come down to heart...
Well, you see, I was only a small fish, but there was a big fight in New York. George Cohen refused to go in for equity, and he founded a union for our organization called the Actors Fidelity League. And they were rivals with Equity, but eventually Equity won out, and they became, there was no more other union. But all these off-Broadway theaters and off-Broadway theaters, they have a deal with Equity. I think that some Equity actors can work with non-union, but only off-Broadway, not on Broadway. And Catherine spoke about, I don't know that she did, but we have a grandson who has been working, acting in an off-Broadway show. And that show has closed, but the same theater and the same outfit is doing right now, last week. You know, the theater has not only changed in the quality of the plays, but in the titles of the plays. I've never heard such titles. The one they're doing this month, or have been doing, is called Consider the Roaches. Would you want to see a play called Consider the Roaches?
Well, I went down.
Parker
wouldn't go to see Michael, but I went with his mother, and we drove in and went to a Sunday matinee. And now there were two Equity girls in that show.
Were there many people in the audience? Were there many people in the audience? How was attendance?
Well, I think there had been, but... Well, just to show you what good business people are, everybody thought the show had closed, but on account of the blackout, they did one more day's performance.
The paper
said... The paper had it closed, so naturally there weren't very many that Sunday. But I wanted to see Michael because he'd done so many things and I had never happened to see him at all. And he was very, very good. And they were all good. They were all good. It was a terrible play. It should have been over in the Abbey Theatre in Dublin about these poor Irish people. Oh, it was the most depressing thing. But he thought it was just wonderful. Just wonderful. But the people were very, very good. And the direction and the lighting and the costuming, all that. But I never saw an Irish play that I liked in my life, although I'm Irish. I don't go to the theater to be depressed. That to that point, anyway.
Do you miss very much the excitement of radio, or did you find radio as exciting as TV or the phone?
Oh, I suppose I miss it, but I'm used to it. Not missing it now. I did enough, I think.
Some people are, some of the people who've been interviewed talk about their dreams of a renaissance, of radio coming back.
I doubt that. I know.
The only two programs that I know of that are being done now are the Radio Mystery Theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard any of those.
I have.
And there's a program on Saturday and Sunday called the General Mills Adventure Theater for children.
Is it for children? I didn't hear it. I heard it announced on the radio.
I haven't heard any of the programs.
No.
A friend of mine who's been tape recording them says it's for children, but adults, if you like adventure, if you like sort of thing, you'd enjoy it as well.
Right.
Kids, whenever I try to get my daughter to listen to one of the tapes, she always complains because she can't see it.
I know.
She likes to be able to see the characters.
Yeah, I know.
Well, you see, that generation is conditioned to that. And they probably don't like black and white at all, and yet I have two neighbors, both with swimming pools, so you know they can buy what they want. And they don't have anything but black and white, but they're older people. Mm-hmm. You know, the Rochfords only have black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I admit I like, we have both at the moment because we have, somebody loaned us, the coal people loaned us a black and white. And I have to admit I prefer the colored. But if I hadn't ever bought a colored, I'd like the black and white just as well. But those children probably haven't been used to radio. Parker always thought and still thinks that when you're using your imagination, that you can imagine the thing better than you can look on television.
Archer talks about that quite a bit when he's interviewed, particularly when you're doing something of a frightening nature. You know, with sound, you can create an image that is more frightening than you can
with photographs. Parker, tell him a story about when you used to have an audience up in the fishbowl, and the little old lady who wrote to you and Arthur for years and finally came down from upstate New York.
She was a... There's your phone. She was a Snow Village listener and fan.
Boss.
I think she was probably had been a school teacher. She used to write little notes to when we went off the air to find out when we were coming back and so forth. And these beautifully written letters. And once she wrote that she was visiting her daughter or niece or something over in Jersey. Oh, she lived in Connecticut. And she was visiting across the river. And could she come over to see a broadcast? Well, there's nothing more boring than seeing a broadcast. But we called her or wrote her or something, asking her to come over. And it so happened that at that particular time, which was one summer, I think, we were doing 15-minute versions of Snow Village, parts of programs, you know, cut down. So it was done in a small studio with not many people in the cast. And Arthur Allen was a very courteous person, and we took her into the control room where she could listen, and she saw the final rehearsal and the broadcast on the air. And then she came out through the studio, and we took her out to the elevator. Now here was a woman who had been listening for years and imagining the church and the school and the grange in the small village. Her only remark was, I should think you'd be bored to death doing this. All illusion was gone, you see. And that's true of radio. I just read before you came an advance notice of the new Dickens program that's going to be on Channel 13. It sounded very good. It was a review of one of the first, the one that's going to be done on Sunday. because I was always a Dickens fan, so I, but there's no question, you know, Channel 13 criticizes, and the Union, but when you see those English-British programs, I tell you, there's no comparison in my mind with most American programs.
Well, there's a series that I'm looking forward to listening to because I wasn't able, you know, they have these programs on every week, and unless you're home,
I know
you miss a particular chapter.
Right, right.
Tonight, I think, they're doing Dorothy L. Sayers, the...
Peter Wimsey.
Yeah, one of the something with a herring in the title. I can't remember the exact title.
I saw them all.
But they're going to do four, one after another tonight.
Back to that.
So that if you were watching it one week and you missed one...
I think we saw them all.
That's...
Yeah, and generally, there was one about Bell Tower, about pulling the...
Nine Tailors.
Yeah, and
I read that.
I was confused. On account of the bell. But generally, I like the man a good bit who played Peter Wimsey. We looked until the series was over at Poldark, P-O-L-D-A, you know.
I haven't seen that, but I've read about it.
It was pretty blood and thunder, but it was well done. And I saw all of the Forsyte saga originally, and Catherine watched it the last time I did. But I forgot which one we like best, but generally I like Masterpiece Theater very much. Mm-hmm. And you know, they waste money, spend money on those ballroom scenes, and the American programs very seldom spend as much money, I think, or else it costs as much or
And of course those are government sponsored, and I would I don't know that they're spending any more money, but they seem not to be afraid of the quality.
That's right.
You know, sometimes when you save money, you're saving money and producing.
I saw, did you happen to see the Adams
Chronicles? A couple of them,
I'm like you, I saw some, but not many. But I thought they were pretty well done. I thought they were well done. That's all I have to say.
Okay. I probably should be leaving now.
No, you shouldn't. I didn't mean that.
I was quite serious when I said that if you do get out, and I really don't know what your schedule is, but if you do get out and you can find your way at least as far as that mall where the theaters are and where the restaurant is, we're just about 5 minutes from that spot.
Yeah, well.
And I'd be happy to have you as a guest.
Well, that's good of you, thank you. Catherine drove since she was a young girl in Chicago. In Chicago, as you know, it's quite different. And then later on, I drove through the South on the most terrible roads, over hundreds, thousands of miles, that I never, never liked to drive. And then Catherine was doing a good deed of some kind, taking a woman to a market or something. And she missed an intersection light, or maybe there wasn't any light. She ran into a car, and nobody was hurt. And the insurance covered the other damage. But she had to take a license test again, operator's test again. And she went over to Carmel, and took it, and it was a gray day, very little, no sunlight, and they gave it to her outdoors, see, and she failed, and she never would go back to drive again any other time. But I still have a license, but I don't usually drive much, because Mary, our girl, lives in Portland, and we hear from her every day or every other day. And she goes to this supermarket and she takes Catherine and brings her home. And so I don't generally drive, but I have a driver's license. But I don't like to drive at night. And I never was a good driver, although I drove a good many thousand miles.
Well, if you want to
but
take advantage of the offer, I'll pick you up and take care of
it. Thank you. But it's good of her. I appreciate that. Now tell me one thing more. We had a neighbor who died a few years ago, a German doctor, very, very nice, and born in Germany, and practiced in Germany. And he used to go to the high school productions over in Curtin of Shakespeare and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
How are they? Are they?
We have, you know, I have, again, I would not call myself much of a critic. But I like the theater, and I like good drama, and I have been to see many, many different amateur performances.
Yeah.
The teacher at Curtin, a fellow named Fred Blaze, I believe is probably one of the most talented directors that I have ever seen working with high school age youngsters.
Yeah.
Almost anything that these boys and girls have done has been, in my view, excellent, only because he is so good.
Yeah.
Their acting is good, but the staging is the key to good drama.
Yes.
He does not let them get away with anything that's sloppy.
No.
And they did, this past summer, they did The Importance of Being Earnest.
Oh, yeah.
They did The Boyfriend, I think, and I'm trying to think of which one. I think they did Julius Caesar this summer. I'm not sure. One of the Shakespeare. They do only one Shakespeare play each summer.
Yeah. Well, I remember distinctly. He died 2 or 3 years ago, and he went over to see Midsummer Night's Dream, and he had seen it in Germany and you know elsewhere, and he praised it to the skies.
If I don't forget, I will send you 2 tickets to the next performance that they do. It may be a little, it may not be a Shakespeare, but
I know.
But I will send you your wife a ticket.
I didn't mean that when I know about it.
Well, that's
I was
right.
Interested because...
Do you know how to get to the high school in Curtin?
Yes, I do. He was very...
Yeah. The teacher at Curtin, a fellow named Fred Blaze, I believe is probably one of the most talented directors that I have ever seen working with high school age youngsters.
Yeah.
Almost anything that these boys and girls have done has been, in my view, excellent, only because he is so good.
Yeah.
Their acting is good, but the staging is the key to good drama.
Yes.
He does not let them get away with anything that's sloppy.
No.
And they did, this past summer, they did The Importance of Being Earnest.
Oh, yeah.
They did The Boyfriend, I think, and I'm trying to think of which one. I think they did Julius Caesar this summer. I'm not sure. One of the Shakespeare. They do only one Shakespeare play each summer.
Yeah, well, I remember distinctly, he died 2 or 3 years ago, and he went over to see Midsummer Night's Dream, and he had seen it in Germany and, you know, elsewhere, and he praised it to the skies.
If I don't forget, I will send you 2 tickets to the next performance that they do. It may be a little, it may not be a Shakespeare, but...
I know.
But I will send you and your wife a ticket.
I didn't mean that when I know about it.
Well, that's all right.
I was interested because...
Do you know how to get to the high school in Curtin?
Yes, I do. He was very enthusiastic, and he was a very bright man. You know, when I spoke about Henry, we have a magazine, which was given to us, and it's given to us each year from a man in an advertising agency. Maybe you know the magazine. People is published by the Time. It is like a cheap gossip column, really. And it writes head articles about, of course, I never heard of it, but that doesn't mean anything. Like rock and roll singers, and I don't know anything about rock and roll singers. But, and these chorus girls who have become overnight stars in television or, but I have found that the real, for the most part, the great people in the profession are the, well, they do like Henry did with me coming out. My first experience in the theater, I think, was in Boston. Forbes Robertson, who was long before your time, of course, he was the greatest Hamlet I ever saw. And he did a repertory. He did Hamlet and Shaw's Caesar and Cleopatra. And the passing of the third board right, third floor back, and a number of them. And I, along with some others, went down and got a dollar, 50 cents maybe, a night for walking on in the crowd seat. In those days, there was no radio to make crowd noises. It was all done physically.
They call them spear carriers.
That's right. And I remember being in the mob in Caesar and Cleopatra. And after this scene in which we had carried spears or something on the stage and yelled at the proper cue, and the curtain went down, and this great man, he was an elderly man then, but he was a mob, he had the courtesy to come over to this ragtag bums off the street and students who are earning 50 cents a night, say, very good boy.
Can I come out?
You see, we have Shakespearean cat, Othello.
Well, he's in there yowling at me while I'm talking, that one, Mary.
Does he have a taste of
what she said, I was telling her about those tapes, and she said, Mother, why don't you get those tapes back and they have something to play it on. Never saw, a show in Boston, let alone a Broadway show, and yet he knew he wanted to be an actor.
How did you get started?
He always wanted to be.
I went to school in Boston, but before that, I always wanted to.
And he used to...
You want that boy holding
on? Could have been. He used to go down to the post office in this town in Maine where he was born, and once he was getting playbills, you know, and the postmaster said to him, some more of those damn dialogues. You know, they probably thought he was as freakish as we think some of these pop stars are.
Do you ever go back? Have you ever been back to your hometown?
Oh, he owns a house up there.
Twice. My brother died a few years ago when I went back. Before that, I hadn't been back for 40 years.
No, he won't go back. He owns a house up there, and I want to go back there in the summer. But he won't go.
No. Do you correspond with anyone from your hometown?
Or? Oh, yes, more or less. I send Christmas presents to them. And
at Christmas. They all did, except one of you.
Oh, they write and beg him to come.
But there must be people. Every town has a famous.
I wasn't there.
No. They don't look at him that way. They like him and they love him, but
I wouldn't know that.
But he would take shows up to Lakewood.
Well, you don't know Lakewood is it's Cowichan, Maine. It's the second oldest summer theater in the country. Ely's Youth Gardens in Denver is there, by Denver is there. And Lakewood, and I have been up there That's inland, you know. And I wrote three plays that were done up there. And I acted in them.
But you go there because it was work. We have well, it's a joke, but it's the truth. People will say, well, now you've been to Europe, and you've been here, and you've been there. Well, why doesn't Parker go? Parker won't go anywhere unless he gets paid. And this is the truth.
Well, it's only for you. Who does he spend the money on if not for you?
No, that's got nothing to do with it. If he got a call, an SOS right now from Hollywood, he would be on the next plane. But if I said, let's go up to Maine and look things over, oh, I wouldn't want to travel all that way. No, he won't go anywhere unless he gets paid. He was down in New Orleans for 13 weeks. He'll say, I can't close the house. What about the animals? And people break in. For 13 weeks, nobody broke in. The animals didn't die or anything. Because it was acting, and he would want to do it. They're all a little strange. You talk about you and your wife getting along in spite of temperament. They're all a little strange. But you learn to live with it. You take the bitter with the better.
I know. I was telling somebody the other day, Fred Allen, as you know, used to have guests on his program. And Fred, being a very curious person, went to see Bela Lugosi, you know, who played Dracula, at his apartment with a man from the William Morris agency, I suppose. And they went over to his apartment in New York, and it was fairly early in the forenoon, and Lugosi had just been getting cleaned up. And he came to the door, and he cut himself shave in the boiler room.
Oh, that is a rich one. That's good.
You know that Fred Allen, for all of his success and all of his money, never owned a house and never owned an automobile. But he walked down the street every night from his apartment, walked down towards Times Square, and he'd have $5 in this pocket and $10 in this pocket and $1 in this pocket and just handed it out.
He had a regular retinue of
that just kind of
followers who, you know, depended
on. The most generous person in the world. But imagine, never owned a car, never went to Europe. I'm talking about
he didn't need one.
No.
He didn't want anything like that.
He used to go to Old Orchard, Maine, or somewhere in the summer, and then he used to go somewhere in Jersey.
But wasn't he from New England also? He
Boston,
had kind of a twang.
Boston. About. His name was Sullivan, but he took the name Allen because he was going to be on an amateur program, and they did it alphabetically. At least that's what he said.
Well, he was a juggler, wasn't he? Did you ever read either one of his books?
No.
Yeah, he was a juggler, but not
in vaudeville.
It's the funny part. As long as I was with him, I don't think I ever heard him say a dirty word or a swear word. But in doing recorded programs, there was a sound effects man who used to be a pianist in the pit in a vaudeville house. And he told me he never liked, appreciated Fred Allen because he used to use this filthy language under his breath, you know, whispering for the orchestra. I never heard him. When Fred was on stage.
He probably knew him at a different time of his life. You know, sometimes you mature, you change. I have a tape recording, not just of several of his programs, but also of an interview done of Fred Allen.
Yeah.
Where he talks about almost regretting being in show business.
Well, he was
wanting another life. He wanted to be a writer or...
Yeah. And he could write very funny material.
But didn't he write a lot of his own material?
Yeah, well, they had writers, but I think he always superintended it.
He has writers to sit in on his, but he didn't want to get involved in that at all. And in one of his books, he speaks about Allen's Alley, and he said how he could always write for Parker better than for any of the other
Allen people. Well, he was from New England.
Yeah, he knew what he could do, and Parker always changed anything he didn't like in any show, any show that he was on.
He always
rewrote it the way he wanted it. But he didn't want to get into that part of it. And, well, he did do it for Kate Smith. He did it for a year and he didn't like it.
I ran into one of the writers out in Hollywood when I was out there once. We used to be with Freddie, he was writing the movies now.
Kate Smith, I understand, has a summer home in Lake Placid.
Yes, she used to go there. I guess she's still there.
I don't know if she's still there. Someone, when I was up in Ticonderoga, somebody told me that she has a home on one of the islands.
Yeah.
Right near Lake Placid, and up there every summer, and the people in the community who all know her don't are curious enough not to bother her because of her personality, but she's quite a person in terms of having introduced so many new acts. Abbott and Costello started with Kate Smith.
The
Aldrich family started with Kate Smith.
Yes, that's right.
Were you one of the characters on her programs, or on her program, or did you just write for her?
Both. And Abbott and Costello were on, and I was on.
What was when, the early 40s? Or?
I would say so, yes. I have to look up the dates. So.
Do you keep a...
No.
Do you keep a scrapbook
no.
of...
No, yeah. He doesn't even have a program or anything. He said, want any pictures of Dorian Gray around. He didn't want to look back, he wanted to look ahead always. Just threw everything away. We haven't a script, as far as I know. If we have, it's well hidden.
I will tell David what I told somebody the other day. I have written a mystery play called Cuckoos on the Hop, and it was tried out in near Gloucester, Mass., and then in New York. At that time, we had a boy who lived, where did he live? He didn't live too far from Stony Street, did he? Well, Wilford. I don't know where he lived.
Yeah, a gardener. Yes, he did live up that way.
Anyway,
yeah.
he was in his 20s, I suppose. And I was in New York so much that he had to take care of the place. And his mother was English, and I think his father was a local product around here. Well, they probably never went to the theater in New York, but he was a great driver. He was a great mechanic for automobile. So I had tickets for my play in New York, and I gave...
Oh, we were very fond of him. We wanted to do... We thought it would be a great thing for him to go and take his family to a Broadway show, especially if Parker had written.
Tickets for himself and his family, mother and father. And he used to come about 3 or 4 times a week. And the next morning I saw him, and I didn't expect him to rave over the play or anything about it. In the play, the probably were a couple of dams, there were a dam and a hill. Nowadays they were teachers in Sunday school, you know. So I didn't open this subject, but all he ever said about the play was, how'd you ever know those swear words?
That was the comment. Of course they didn't like it, they weren't attuned to Broadway shows. We were stupid to even think that he liked it,
well,
you know.
I never knew what he did.
Parker, you know, Parker directed at Beechwood for a couple of years.
That is Scarborough School.
Yeah, Beechwood Players. And we've always maintained, you give away free tickets, people don't like the show. They think, well, I paid all this money, and I've taken a lot of trouble to think it out. But if you just give them tickets, they don't like it. It's human nature, I guess.
If you give them something, it's probably not worth anything.
That's exactly it.
If they had to pay for it, then it's going to be worth something.
That's just exactly it. But it's hard when you have the tickets and can give it to feel that way, but you really should.
Well, you have to know who you're giving it to also. There are some people who give a lot of teeth for that opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. Wilford did live up that way, and he lives now on that on the highway.
Well, I genuinely lived on Sony Street, the Burnsons.
Yeah. He was an old car buff, and he used to go around like, you know, they get these old cars and go and...
Antique.
Yeah, really antique. He was marvelous. He taught both of our girls to drive. I was going to teach him, but I had to have a bat in my hand to hit him every time, and they say you should never teach in your own family. So in desperation, we asked Wilford if he'd do it, but they didn't have these teachers when they were learning. The minute they were 16, they wanted to, you know, get their license. And he taught them, and he was so wonderful, and they both are good drivers, one better than the other because it's her temperament, but he was wonderful.
Turn that off.
I wish I had him now.